my irritation arises not only because of the raw quality of so much of the commentary, but because it sets the tone for the public. I'm likely to be deluged in the next few weeks by sentiments of hooray, the recession is over and things are getting better, followed a little later up by you economists misled us. Things haven't improved at all. We did. We did not mislead you. You chose to listen to people who were commenting beyond their competence. That's not the economists' fault, nor is the fault if the public relies on the same people to initiate them into the mysteries of GDP and economic growth. If one listens to dwarves, the stories you hear are going to be a bit on the short side of genuine content. So we face a confusing story. Much of economics may be scientific, but many economists are not. In any case, most of the public learn their economics from those who could not possibly be considered professional economists. One last attempt to convince you that economics is a science, and like all sciences, it's complex and subtle. Let me look at three areas where economics is progressing. Notice how in each case the evolution is due to a dialogue between theory and fact, and how, like all scientists, I make no apology if the current theory is to be replaced by a better one, albeit one that stands on the shoulders of the older one. And those of you who come from different sciences to me will all in your own disciplines know of stories rather similar to this. Now I'm going to give you three. In the nature of things, some people I'm going to mention in this series, in this section of things, are not quite giants. But I need to mention names in order to give you pointers, and some of the people I'm going to talk about are pretty tall. First of all, I want to talk about economic behaviour. First, there is a theory of individual economic behaviour. And economists need one of that because we want to talk about people. For a long time, economists have held, in an increasingly rigorous form, the notion of rational economic man, Homo economus. He's always a he, takes all that is known into consideration and pursues his own self-interest by maximising his utility, which reflects only his welfare. Evelyn's reflection suggests that each of us doesn't actually behave like this, but the theory is held up for the simple scientific reason that there was no better one to replace it. I might say that when we use it for policy purposes, many of us make ad hoc adjustments to bring Homo economus closer to actual behaviour. So we have a theory, but then when we're applying the theory, we do make those adjustments. Of course, we know about the problems of it. Recently, some economists have been looking at the psychological literature to obtain insights to human behaviour. Among my heroes are Richard Thaler, Matthew Raben, and Daniel Kahneman, who is a psychologist who received what's the so-called Nobel Prize in 2002 in economics. It's actually technically the prize awarded by the Bank of Sweden in the honour of Alfred Nobel. Now, why has economics not yet got a rigorous alternative theory? But it's certainly making progress. I tell you to point out that economics evolves. While there's a lot of resistance to behavioural economics, and some of the strongest resistance comes from those who have a political agenda, who think it justifies the state overruling ruling individual preferences. So that, and Keynes actually said at some stage that you never learn anything after the age of 30. Sometimes I think you learn everything that matters in kindergarten. But what we've got with those people who are resisting it because it conflicts with their political theories is the same as those Lysenkoans, isn't it? Meanwhile, you'll find increasing application of the theory in economics and policy. And you had one, was it last year or the year before? Kiwi Saver was actually based on the Thalerian theory of saving. You didn't know that, did you? So. We've got the area, we know it's got problems, we're trying to improve it, and that's what science is about. Second topic I want to talk about is happiness and material consumption. And as an example, which happens in many sciences, you have an anomaly which you cannot resolve, and we're trying to make progress. 200 years ago, Jeremy Bentham said that the more you consumed, the happier you were. That's been a central assumption of economics ever since, but is it true? Now, we've only had the data to test the proposition in recent years. To me, science is very driven by new science, by new data, by new facts. The most important of this new data is asking whether people are happy and comparing the responses to their income after controlling for other variables. There is some research, incidentally, which suggests people's subjective responses are consistent with objective data. So, but it's a very treacherous area, but just allow me to proceed. When we pull together the available evidence, we find that a rise in average material consumption in poorer societies seems to be associated with rising average happiness. Okay, in a poor society, that's true. In Bentham's society, it's probably true. However, that does not seem to apply to affluent societies. The best example, and it comes from the longest data run we've got, is that consumption has doubled in the United States since the Second World War, and there's been no rise in average happiness. So, double consumption, no rise in happiness. Now, although rising average incomes do not increase happiness over time, those with higher incomes at any point in time are happier than those with lower incomes. So if you're on 120,000, you'll be happier than if you're on 20,000. After you adjust for all the other things, and I'll talk about some of those adjustments in a moment. Now, I've been doing some work in this area, and I'll tell you. If you're on, we have a scale of 0 to 10, which you score. If you're on 20,000, your average happiness, control for everything else, is 8.1. If you're on 120,000 a year, your average happiness is 8.3. It's higher, it's statistically higher, but it actually is not a compelling argument for that. And you might say, well, isn't 0.2 a big increase? Well, let me give you some examples. If a person is employed and becomes unemployed on the same income, their happiness falls by 0.5. So a much bigger change than what I've just mentioned. And even more dramatically, the happiness of a married woman who becomes separated falls by 0.6. Okay? And for a man, watch this, who moves from marriage to separation, it falls 1.2. on the other hand, single men are happier than single women. But so that changed, sixfold increase in income, little change in happiness compared with other variables. So income is not as important in determining happiness as a range of other, not economic things are. Insofar as income is important, seems to be because it demonstrates one is higher up the pecking order rather than the additional material consumption it generates. Now, what all this means is unclear. We have an anomaly, we're trying to sort it out. And if you're interested in this, probably the best book to look at is Richard Layard's book, and it's simply called Happiness. And I don't agree with everything he says, but you know, it's a place where you can duck into and get a feel about it. Well, that's my second example. My third example is the global financial crisis. And it represents a major row, a very exciting row. Economists do have good rows, I promise you, on what's going on at the moment. Actually, the disagreement that this row has blown into has been going on for a long time, but new facts, new events have exposed it. Now, it would take me more than an afternoon to explain the whole of the theory, the whole of the issues, so I'm just going to give you a limited account. Following the Great Depression of the 1930s, Keynes wrote his General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money, I hadn't noticed before until today. Do you notice that the word GDP isn't in the title of the most important book of the 20th century, economics of the 20th century? No GDP. The General Theory of Employment, Interest and Money. And it became the basis of what we call the Keynesian paradigm of how the macroeconomy works. By the 1960s, it was challenged by monetarism. Incidentally, the expression monetarism was not invented until 1968. People say, of course, monetarism is 19th century. Can't be. Didn't exist then. But that sort of monetarist argument has evolved to the point where it is said that its founders, and the person you would know would be Milton Friedman, would no longer recognise the paradigm. Actually, he can't, he's dead. But that's very unfair, he's a very important contributor. But you've read too many journals. This alternative paradigm, which had a lot of Keynesian apparatus in it, it didn't actually sort of go off in the opposite direction. Say, it's not a question of evolution, it's a question of creationism. It was a different account of how the economy worked within a macro framework. Became dominant for policy purposes at the US Federal Reserve. And of course in the popular press, and businesses liked it. It's a very simplistic thing, so obviously business people like it. What happened in the academy was it became divided, and in the jargon, in American jargon, between the saltwater economists and the freshwater economists. A saltwater economist is one generally who lives on the sea, at the great universities in the sea, on the borders, on the east and west borders of America. The freshwater economists are those who live inland. And of course, you naturally think of Chicago, but a number of other universities that are freshwater economists. So there is this major row going on between these two. Now, in the economy, this academy, this has all been good competitive fun with lashings of rhetoric and some, I'm afraid, personal abuse. Economists, when they run out of arguments, go on to a personal abuse, I'm afraid. In the policy domain, there's a very uneasy truce. The arrival of the global financial crisis has now turned the truce into open public war. And, of course, the big issue has been that the Keynesians have had to take over, the Keynesian policies have to take over to save the world. I mean, the reason why this recession is shorter than the Great Depression is because of the Keynesian financial injections, but don't think that that solved everything. Now, what I want you to think of for a moment is the dispute over whether light was a wave or a particle. But shift it to the 21st century with... So if that sort of dispute's going on, shift it to the 21st century with its great almost public communication. Just think what in the 17th century they'd been able to have sort of rows on these ones. And more immediate policy concerns. Now, it took about 300 years to settle that particular issue. Can anyone remember what the answer was? Was it light, a wave, or a particle?
Both.
Now, I've tried to put the argument fairly, but I don't want to be seen to be sitting on the fence. Briefly, my position is I'm a Keynesian, although I have some doubts about American Keynesianism, because I think it's too influenced by the particularities of the US government arrangements. Moreover, I don't think Americans have thought enough about being in the privileged position of issuing the currency of the world, so it means that they actually have got it oversimplistic. Let me give an example. Everyone knows if you do a monetary expansion, monetarists tell you that there will be inflation. America hasn't had any inflation, has it? Therefore, it's wrong. Actually, what's happened is that the poor old Chinese have got all their money in US dollars, have actually found the value of their holdings has fallen. That's what we mean by inflation. but it's happening in a different way to the way that it's normally presented. So I've warned you that economics can be complex and subtle. You may be surprised I should be Keynesian, given that Keynes published his book almost three quarters of a century ago. It's about the same times as Bohr's complementarity principle, Heisenberg's uncertainty principle, Pauli's exclusion principle, and Schrödinger's equations. They all remain the foundations of quantum mechanics, but of course the subject has evolved. So has economics. An even better example might be that we celebrate the 150th anniversary of Darwin's On the Origins of the Thesis of Species. The book still speaks to us, and even if the theory has to be enriched by a host of subsequent research, Keynes's general theory has a similar status. So let me finish this brief discussion with a cryptic remark, that I reckon the progress will not just happen with the global financial crisis testing the two paradigms. There'll have to be a new theoretical innovation based on some previously unavailable empirical data. That's the way science progresses. Keynes knew about them. I speculate that the most likely place will be incorporating balance sheet into a Keynesian model. Keynes knew about the balance sheet, but he just didn't have the data to be able to actually incorporate it systematically into his model count, except very crudely. However, there is a bigger lesson here. Paradigmatics battles are not resolved as easily in the social sciences as the natural sciences. But it's worth recalling Planck's law, and he, after all, was a physicist. So this is what he said. How do paradigmatic battles get settled in the sciences? Now, of course, it was in German. Here's an English translation. A new scientific truth does not triumph by convincing its opponents and making them see the light, but rather because its opponents eventually die. The new generation grows up that is familiar with it. And that may be true in physics. It's certainly true, that's even more so, in the social sciences. So what I've tried to do today is answer the question of whether economics is a science. My conclusion is there's a strongly scientific element in much of economics, and many economists are scientists. Regrettably, many of those who use economics do not do so in a scientific way, which is why it's right to be sceptical about what you're told are economic truths. But that does not mean they do not exist.
Time is moving on, but I'm sure you have some questions. What I would like is, if you were to ask questions, they're questions of clarifying what Brian was talking about, rather than making statements and asking whether he agrees or not. Are you with me there? So that you will start...
I agree or not, the answer is yes.
So you will simply start with a question, and I wish the question would be something to clarify something that he's already said in his presentation. We'll start with you, then we'll be going there. Go ahead.
You talked about economics not being dependent on growth, especially with Gabby talking this morning about possibly the Earth's population plateauing, but all hope. Wouldn't that cause the economy to stop growing?
You've confused economics with the economy. And remember, what I said was that if an economy slows down and stops growing, the profit rate goes down to zero, and you can't have capitalism with zero profit rates. So it will be a different sort of economy. But for the most of the human condition, we haven't had a capitalist economy. So don't panic.
Stay up, Bob. Brian.
Yep. Yes, Brian, you referred earlier to GDP as an inadequate measure of welfare. Yep. I might have got this wrong, but I'd assume that some economists prefer to talk about measures of wealth rather than welfare.
Now, wealth is quite a different concept. For us, wealth, and it's an economist definition, you can use whatever you like. Wealth is simply the stock of assets valued at current prices. So it's a totally different notion. People often confuse, as you say, wealth and welfare, deficits and debt. You know, you can, about one in three journalists manage to make a straightforward confusion like that.
There's someone down there I got to before. The gentleman at the back there. Yes, that's you. Yep.
Thanks, Phil Thomas.
Just if I ask a question from a great depth of ignorance here, as scientists...
Hi, Socrates!
As scientists, we care greatly about the accuracy of the things that we measure, one with the other. How happy are you personally with a measurement of happiness as an emotion expressed in a numeric scale?
What I said was this. We asked people to make subjective assessments, and there is some empirical evidence. You'll find some of it in Lanyard's book, which shows that one, for instance, if you ask people, if they're friends, they'll give roughly the same objective answer about your happiness as you will. That's one answer. Lanyard is very interesting. He started to look at brain patterns, and there is some evidence that brain patterns are consistent with your subjective evidence. It's not perfect. But I tell you what, mate, if you can solve that problem, we'll make some progress.
Brian, you talked about changes of 0.1%, 0.2%. Do economists have the concept of noise in their data? And secondly, do they also have the concept of the uncertainty principle, which is that the measurement itself alters the nature of the data you get?
On the whole, the uncertainty principle doesn't arrive, because you may remember that it only applies at very small levels. So when you measure the location of the Earth, on the whole, you don't bump it much. Now, you have to remember that economists are very unimportant, so we don't have much effect. As for noise, economists have made enormous contributions in statistical methods. And you may remember, I talked about measurement error. I talked about revisions. So we're very conversant with those sorts of problems.
This is the last question.
Ryan, Paul Saxby, one of your former students. Do you have any confidence that the committee that's set up to look at how to catch up with Australia in terms of wealth will actually do what you suggest they should do and go back and look at the failure of the 84-93 period?
I'm a scientist. Let's say I have a hypothesis. Let's see whether it is correct. I hope, because I'm not only a scientist, that they will look at that. I will be surprised if they do, but I will be very glad if I'm wrong.
Okay. Thank you, Brian. Brian Easton, it's been fantastic, hasn't it? I've really got to thank you.